Well, good afternoon to everyone. It's been a interesting week from a lot of perspectives. And my wife was down in L.A. I was able to go down Monday afternoon and spend a few days with my new grandchildren that are very tiny. The twins were about 4.5 and 5.5 pounds. I've never held a baby 4.5 pounds before. Just, you know, kind of hold them like this, and there's the legs and the feet, and they're just kind of that big. And, you know, the head kind of bobbles and flops. But they're doing well. They're eating, and they're breathing well. A little boy had a couple, kind of some liver enzyme issues on his first blood test, so they took him back in. Looked like everything was getting back to normal pretty quickly. But my poor little wife slept the first 2 weeks with both of them in bed with her, and she had to get up every 2 hours to take them in to nurse. They had to eat every 2 hours or their blood sugar level would go low or something. Being a man, I'm not, you know, don't think in those terms. But at any rate, let's just say she hasn't had a lot of sleep in the last few weeks, so glad to get her home so she can at least get some sleep and kind of recover a little bit. And the other grandparents came in right after we left, so my daughter will have a little bit of help during her time to recover. But it certainly is a great blessing, as the Psalms say, to see your children's children upon your knee and look at a little guy or a little girl and say, wow, this is, you know, a part of me continuing down through the years. So it's really a blessing, and just certainly hope they're able to grow up in a world that is, well, it's very dangerous, obviously. This last week, you may have seen North Korea said they exploded a nuclear device, not an atomic device, but a hydrogen-based nuclear explosion. Our government immediately said it wasn't a nuclear explosion. I don't know why they said that. They had no evidence, and it went 5.7 on the Richter scale, which could have been only a very seriously large bomb exploded in North Korea. We already know they have satellite missiles that they've launched satellites with, so they have missiles that would be able to reach the West Coast, and I hope that they never do. But certainly the week started out on kind of a bad note. And then, of course, the challenges with the Chinese economy and other issues and the ongoing political games that are played in this country. It's not a very pleasant week in the news, certainly. So we'll see what the rest of the year portends. But January started out, you know, a little bit of a challenge as far as our world news is concerned. But there's good news always within God's church. We know that God's kingdom is one day closer every day that we arise. Let me have some local announcements here first. A ladies' choir, there'll be a meeting for the ladies who would like to participate in the ladies' choir at the women's weekend. Please meet in front of the stage 10 minutes after services. Please reserve the evening of January 30th for a festive evening of food, fellowship, and fun. It says, as we salute our Mexican brothers and sisters with a Mexican-themed potluck. Please bring a main dish and salad or dessert. If you'd like to help with decorations, please see Sharon Browning. So we have a little announcement about the potluck coming up, potluck and games on January the 30th, so that should be fun. So we'll get together and figure out some games. Have we ever had a newlywed or oldiewed game here? That's fun. We could have some of the oldiewed couples challenge some of the newlywed couples. We'll see. It's always a lot of fun. There are a lot of other ideas, too. Also, February the 6th, which is about a month away, the Salem congregation is planning a fun-filled evening, a potluck meal, costume dance, games, and activities for the kids. 2016 Winter Social. And I believe our teen choir is going down to perform special music on that for that day for the Salem people. So it should be a lot of fun. So I'll leave this bulletin announcement for over on the bulletin board. Tomorrow is our first meeting for the Spokesman's Club, the actual first speakers meeting. Tomorrow, January the 10th at 5:30 p.m. at the Barberton Grange. Be ready to answer questions for table topics and enjoy our first regular meeting of the year. And certainly any guests who would like to come and see what we do at Spokesman's Club are more than welcome. Also, teen young adult choir practice, 20 minutes today after services. So teen young adult choir practice, 20 minutes today after services. Also, the Spokane, Washington congregation is pleased to announce, of course, its annual tradition of the Winter Family Ski Weekend, January 15th to the 17th. Friday night begins with a Bible study, and of course, Sabbath services and a dance, and then skiing on Sunday. I heard that Mr. Mickelson came through his operation this week very well, and the doctors have told him it's okay for him to go to Africa. Some people are just diehards for punishment, you know. So, but he wants to, I think it's 2 days after the ski weekend in Spokane, he's leaving for a two-week trip of West Africa. So certainly can use our prayers. All right, Tacoma again, February 13th to 15th. The Tacoma Youth and Family Invitational Weekend will also have that announcement on the bulletin board. So I hope you've all been following daily with your Bible reading program. This week we're up through finishing Genesis 24 and continuing on trying to finish Genesis by the end of next week. And certainly that very foundational book of not only mankind's creation, but God dealing with Abraham and all the many, many truisms and truths in Genesis that are still with us today about God and his judgment, his coming kingdom, and just so many things that we really need to know about that fabulous book. I didn't bring a copy of the E-News. I did mention quite a bit this week about winter camp. So we may just have to ask Warren and a couple others who were at winter camp how things went. My wife showed me a bunch of the pictures. Looks like a very nice group, about 63 or 64 campers. Wasn't that right? Is that right, Sean? 63, 64 campers. Did they have snow? They had some snow. Okay, so they had some snow. So that's fun. I know winter camp is sort of our last camp of the year. And as soon as winter camp is over, then we're able to compile the statistics. And then everything begins to get into big gear for next year. We've already had our camp director meeting, of course, and we have to begin working January 15th, which is coming up, is our deadline to get our suggestions in for our daily themes. And then we have to start working on the Bible studies, the Christian living classes, and the rest of the programs for the year. And so about every 2 weeks from here on out until camp starts, we will have deadlines to make, and we probably have at least one more WebEx meeting, perhaps two. But most of camp work takes place before camp ever starts. And then when camp starts, it's sort of, it's finally over. They can relax, although the staff certainly can't relax. But part of the camp program now is this Compass Check magazine, which I received this week. It is automatically sent to all those who were campers last year. And part of the purpose of the magazine is to keep the campers in contact with each other, but more than that, to keep them in contact and familiar with the lessons that we've taught them at summer camp. A very nicely done magazine. It's mentioned here that we are fearfully and wonderfully made, learning to love myself the way God does, dream big and serve God, escape the jealousy trap, five ways of Christians. Some good articles. All of us that are camp directors review these articles and make suggested changes. We do want the magazine to be written mostly by those who have been campers in recent years, meaning young adults, those who might be in their latter years of being campers. So if you'd like to write an article for the magazine, I'd be glad to help you with that. I began writing for church publications when I was only a freshman in college. It wasn't necessarily by choice. It was because I was taking journalism class. And one day, John Robinson walked into our journalism class and said he'd just gotten permission for the publication of a new publication called The Worldwide News. Some of you might remember that publication started in January of 1973, I believe it was. January, maybe it was in the springtime anyway. So he said, since we don't have any staff, then those of you who are here taking this class are hereby deputized as the Worldwide News staff. And they were men in that class like Scott Ashley, a number of others. Klaus Roth was a little bit ahead of us, but he was there. Mike Hale, several other guys whose names still come down to us today in our church publications. And my assignment was to be, quote, the feature article writer, which I found to be somewhat of a challenge, trying to find something to write about. But when I began flying around with the Ambassador Singers. And that was not the group that did the feast films, but the group that flew around to be the public appearance campaign singers. So since I was doing that, then I got to write all these articles to put in the Worldwide News about what happened at the various campaigns around the country that were going on at that time. Back then, we didn't have internet. We didn't have email. We didn't have word processing. Basically, we had the old style of doing everything as we look at it now. So we had to, if I had the chance to get back to campus, I could sort of hand write out the article on the airplane and then send it in or give it to Melody Searles. If not, we were able to call in on the telephone line and they would record the article, but you had to read it with punctuation. So you had to say space, period, comma, and then new paragraph. So it's not easy to do that. So one time we had this campaign in St. Louis, I think it was. St. Louis. So sort of a long story, but I won't take too much time. And the campaign was supposed to start on a Friday evening. So I think it was Friday night, Saturday night, Sunday night campaign, whatever it was. Maybe it was Saturday night, Sunday night. Anyway, I forget. I think it was Saturday night, Sunday night. It was Friday. Because about 1 o'clock in the afternoon, Alan Heath finds me, and I was in the dining hall. He said, Rex, he said, there's this campaign going on in St. Louis, and since I didn't send the ambassador singers, there's no one up there to do this article. And we have to have it for Monday morning. They would save me a blank section of the front page of the Worldwide News every Monday morning because it went to press Monday afternoon and was mailed out on Tuesday to everybody in the United States. And so when we had these campaign articles to do, I had to have them done on Sunday night, the very latest. And then they would do this, Dixon Cartwright would typeset them all, get them right onto the front page of the Worldwide News, and then it would be printed that evening on Monday night and then be sent out Tuesday morning. So Alan Heath tells me, he said, man, he said, get out to the airstrip. He said, I've arranged for them to send an airplane up to take you up to St. Louis to go to this campaign and write this article. I thought, man, score. This is the coolest thing I've ever done, you know. So I got out there, and of course, word had gotten around there was the King Air going to St. Louis. So all the important names decided they were going to go. So when I got out there, I got these looks like, what is this? You know, there's vermin in the room with us. What's going on? So I said, hey, I'm going to go up to, I'm going up to St. Louis. So anyway, the pilot was pretty nice. He was a good friend of mine, at least twice. We became good friends. But all the seats were taken up, all 8 seats in the King Air were taken up by people who wanted to go up to the campaign, and they had seniority, obviously. So I had nowhere to sit, and then Klaus Roth went up as the photographer. So he came back. Finally, the pilot came back. And he said, I got a place for you. I said, where is that? He said, well, you can sit on the toilet. So the toilet in the back of the plane had a little pad on it, and it did have this little seatbelt thing. But it's the very back of the plane. You kind of walk in the door, and it's sort of there in a little compartment while everybody else turned left and went up into the nice padded seats. So I got to sit on this toilet all the way up to and basically in a closed, locked, completely dark little room. So I got up there to St. Louis, and then Klaus said, man, we got to run when we get here because we're going to get in late. There was a storm coming in. So we landed in the St. Louis airport, and there were important people there to meet all the important people. And then Klaus Roth and I took off, and we went off with one of the deacons who had arranged to meet us. And I ran around with that little pad and got quotes, and Klaus got pictures. And so we started writing. And then on the way home, the storm hit in big-time seriousness. And so this little plane is being bounced all over the place, in all these storms and wind when they were trying to find different altitudes. And so everybody else was in their padded seats. I was sitting on the toilet in the back with a flashlight in one hand trying to write my article in the other hand. And it didn't turn out very legible. But we got in about 5:30 in the morning, and I was able to get back over to the press building. And I went through the article with Melanie, and she got it all typed up, and then we got it put into the Worldwide News. And no one that I know of ever knew that that article was written by somebody who was seasick sitting on the toilet in the back of a bouncy plane. So, but it was, and it worked, and we got the publication out. So being a journalist or being a writer has its times when there are some interesting adventures, I would guess. And I believe if we have some of our young men and ladies who would like to learn to write, you might be surprised what opportunities might come your way sometime. So I'd be glad to help you with that. I did go through a lot of writing classes in college, and I've had a lot of articles published over the years, even though I'd like to do more of that, because I think things that are written sometimes have more lasting value than just things that are said. So certainly we'll see that as time goes on. But we do need help with the Compass Check magazine, and if you'd like to help with that and learn to maybe have something to add to your resume and your skills, then please let me know. I think just for sake of time, we'll just go right into the sermon for today. Today I want to answer the most important question that has ever been asked. The most important question that was ever asked not by a converted Christian, but by a Roman governor. And it was asked during the time of a very intense and difficult trial of an innocent man who had been falsely accused. But Pontius Pilate turned to Jesus Christ and said, "What is truth? What is truth?" The most important question ever asked, because the world is wallowing in a sea of false answers, unable to find their way. And of course, we see society heading the same direction as it did during the time of Noah, thousands of years ago, where eventually every thought of man's heart was only evil continually. And secondly, the world became filled with violence. I'm going to read from an article called "What is Truth?" The article's author is a man named Matt Slick, S-L-I-C-K. He posted this on a webpage. He is the president and founder of Christian Apologetics and Research. He says, "What is truth? It is a very simple question. Of course, answering it isn't so simple. We can offer definitions like truth is that which conforms to reality, fact, or actuality. But this basic definition is not complete because its definition is open to interpretation and a wide variety of applications. What is reality? We now have virtual reality, computer programs, and other graphics that seem more real than fiction. What is fact? What is actuality? How does perception affect truth?" This is what philosophy sometimes does. As we approach a goal, it actually prevents us from getting to that goal. It is sometimes so clouding of the issue that nothing can be known for sure. The ancient Greeks came to that conclusion. "See to it that no man takes you captive through philosophy or vain deceit," is what Paul taught in Colossians chapter 2 and verse 8. In order for truth to be defined properly, it would have to be factually and logically a correct statement. In other words, it would have to be true. But perhaps we could look further at truth by determining what it is not. Truth is not error. Truth is not self-contradictory. Truth is not deception. And of course, it could be true that someone is deceptive, but the deception itself is not truth. We live in a land of relativism. In relativism, all points of view are equally valid, and all truth is relative to the individual. If this were true, then it would seem that this is the only truth. But the problem is that in reality, relativism isn't true for the following basic reason. If what is true for me is that relativism is false, then is it true that relativism is false? If you say no, then what is true for me is not true, and relativism is false. If you say yes, then relativism is false, and relativism seems only to defy the very nature of truth, namely that truth is not self-contradictory. I hope you got all of that. But you can see that the philosophers for eons have gone through such verbal machinations and gymnastics trying to arrive at truth. Continuing, if there is such a thing as truth, then we should be able to find it. If truth cannot be known, then it doesn't exist. But if it does exist, for example, we know it's true you're reading this or listening to this. But is there such a thing as something that is always true all the time? Yes, there is this truth. Something cannot bring itself into existence. The preceding truth is found in logic, but there are truths that are not logical by nature. It is true that I love my wife. This isn't logically provable via theorems and formulas and logic paradigms, but it is nevertheless true. I like this paragraph. If we ever hope to determine if there is such a thing as truth apart from cultural and personal preferences, we must acknowledge that we are then aiming to discover something greater than ourselves, something that transcends culture and individual inclinations. To do this, we must look beyond ourselves and outside of ourselves. In essence, it means we are looking for God. God would be truth, the absolute and true essence of being and reality, who is the author of all truth. If you are interested in truth beyond yourself, then you must look to God. I want to begin today over in John chapter 14. The answer to what is truth is the basis for your life. In fact, the understanding of what is truth is the greatest blessing you could have in this life, and is one that is only shared by those people whom God has called and opened their minds to understand the truth, and then they have responded by being obedient and essentially developing a love for truth. In John chapter 14 and verse 5, Thomas said to him, "Lord, we don't know where you are going, and how can we know the way?" On this very challenging night of the Passover, and then later his arrest in Gethsemane, and then trial and then crucifixion, these troubled disciples said, "Well, you're going somewhere, we can't go with you, why not? And how can we follow you where you're going if we don't know where?" Jesus answered to him, "I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me." So Jesus Christ said very plainly that he was the way, which means the way for salvation, the way to attain a relationship with our Creator, the way to find our Creator, and that he is the truth and the life. Some will dismiss his claim, philosophers who dismiss the Bible dismiss his claim, but he's the mainstay of hope. This word of God that he's giving to us is given by a man who walked on water, who claimed divine origin, who rose from the dead, and said he was the originator and the keeper of truth. He's either right or he is wrong. If he is right, then we must acknowledge that and follow it. If he is wrong, then we have to find some, or we believe he is wrong, then we have to dismiss his claims and then search for a different source of truth. Indeed, mankind has been doing that for quite a number of years. Truth versus falsehood perhaps is the same as truth versus deception. Because if something is not true, then it is false. And if it's believed by people, it is a deception. Let's go back over to John chapter 8, that great chapter where he discusses this principle of truth. But notice there is a requirement. If you are going to learn truth and live by truth, you must also keep it in order to keep it. You must obey it and live by it in order to keep it. One of the principles of truth is that if you understand it academically and then reject living accordingly, you will lose the truth that you once had. John chapter 8 and verse 31, Jesus said to those Jews who believed him. These Jews believed him. It's interesting, if you read through the Gospels and Jesus Christ's discourses with the Pharisees and the Jews, there are two groups. There are those who believe him and believe who he is, and then there's the other group that tries to discount him. They don't believe him, and they don't believe that he was sent from God or that he was the Son of God. So sometimes in these discourses, as Jesus Christ is having conversations that are recorded for us, conversations with these men, it's important for us to understand which group he's talking to. In this case, he's talking to those who believed him. He says, "If you abide in my word, you are my disciples indeed." But notice that requirement. We must abide in his words. We'll be his learners, or learning from him indeed. And verse 32, "Then you shall know the truth, and the truth shall set you free." Learning truth is not just an academic endeavor. It is not just a matter of reading an encyclopedia or reading even the Word of God and saying, "Oh, this is true, I understand it." Learning truth is also a matter of obeying it, of abiding in my word, then you are my disciples indeed. You shall know the truth, and the truth shall set you free. They answered him and said, "We are Abraham's descendants." And that was the truth. And of course, they said, "We've never been in bondage," which was a big lie. They had been in bondage to a number of nations, Babylon, Assyria, and others. "How can you say you will be made free?" He answered, "Most surely I say to you, whoever commits sin is a slave of sin. And a slave does not abide in the house forever, but a son abides forever. Therefore, if the Son makes you free, you shall be free indeed." So it would be abiding in his words and the Son then making you free, the Son being Jesus Christ, that you are truly free, free because you know the truth. One of the greatest jails, one of the most sufferable situations in life, is to believe falsehoods that harm you and perhaps do great damage to your emotion and your psyche. Many of us have been to funerals or memorial services where the relatives believe that the decedent is now burning in some punishable place down in the middle of the earth, or is perhaps destined for a lifetime of torment and suffering for eons after that. And they suffer for it greatly. I knew another minister years ago who had a next-door neighbor who had her son die. I think he was a teenager, died in an accident or of some disease. I forget exactly why. But she was crying and wailing so loud at night he couldn't go to sleep. So he walked over there with his Bible and said, "I'd like to talk to you. Maybe we could help you a little bit." And she just said her son was being tormented and suffering forever because he never accepted Jesus and whatever. So he was able to sit and talk to her about the second resurrection and about one of the, you know, the fabulous truths that we have. And I think it helped her from what he said. It helped her somewhat. I don't know anything more about it than his story about it. But that happens oftentimes when we go to funerals or memorial services and people believe that their deceased relatives are now condemned to a suffering forever. That's just one example of a prison of believing untruth, a prison of falsehood. Down in verse 37, he says, "I know that you are Abraham's descendants." Okay, that's true. "But you seek to kill me because my word has no place in you." So in this section here in John 8, he talks about him being the truth. You shall know the truth. But there are requirements to know the truth. Abiding in his word. Abiding as a son forever in his house. And in this case, because his word should have a place in us. Not just believing academically, but internalizing truth is what then allows you to understand more truth. Verse 38, "I speak what I have seen with my father, and do what you have seen with your father." So he spoke the truth, but he began telling them then that their real father, spiritually speaking, the doctrines they believed were not of God, but were of Satan the devil. Verse 39, "They answered and said to him, Abraham is our father." That was their claim to fame. That was their claim to being able to inherit blessings from God. And Jesus said to them, "If you were Abraham's children, you would do the works of Abraham." And of course, Abraham obeyed his laws and commandments and his charge, and his statutes, Genesis 26 and verse 5. He says, "But now you seek to kill me, a man who has told you the truth, which I heard from God. And Abraham did not do this." So these people heard the truth. Perhaps they understood some of it superficially, but their reaction was then to try to kill the messenger. "You do the words of your father." And of course, their father was the devil. Verse 43, we'll drop a couple verses here of an argument they vainly tried to make with him. "Why do you not understand my speech? Because you are not able to listen to my word." Their disobedient attitude caused them to be unable to understand the truth. "You are of your father the devil, and the desires of your father you want to do. He was a murderer from the beginning and does not stand in the truth because there is no truth in him." The demons understand truth academically. They acknowledge to Jesus Christ, "Are you here to punish us before the time?" They know what their final punishment is. But they do not stand in the truth. They reject it. It says, "When he speaks a lie, he speaks from his own resources, for he is a liar and the father of it." We live in a society that belongs to Satan the devil. He's the architect. He's the one who influences the society in which we live. And so we have a society that has rejected truth and is based on a variety of lies. Down in verse 45, "Because I tell the truth, you don't believe me. And which of you convicts me of sin? Which of you can say I've done something sinful?" Of course, the answer is none. "If I tell the truth, why do you not believe me?" And in verse 47, he summarizes what he's saying here. "Which of you convicts me of sin?" I'm sorry, verse 47. He who is of God hears God's word. Now, the phrase, he who is of God, means somebody who is trying to obey God. Somebody who is honestly and sincerely trying to obey the words that he hears. He who is of God hears God's words, and therefore you do not hear because you are not of God. One of the challenges of our time is for people to understand that truth is not fluid, but the understanding of truth is fluid. That if people reject truth, but even the truth that they might have already understood is gradually taken away from them. Let's go over to Matthew chapter 15 and verse 1. Here we have some men who had, because of their tradition and because of their replacing of the truth of God with the ideas of men, had lost sight of the truth that they once had. I think all of us could probably, if we go back very many years, think of people who were at one time zealous for the truth, people who understood the truth by the way they lived, by the way they kept God's commandments, the Sabbath, the holy days, the way they tried to live according to all that we knew as truth. And yet when an opportunity came to turn away from that and to live a life more like the world, it was amazing how quickly truth left. In some cases, it seemed like just days or weeks, and all that they had learned seemed to have disappeared. Because there is a requirement that we hold fast and live by the truth that we know if we are going to keep it, harbor it, and then increase the truth in our lives. Matthew 15 and verse 1, the scribes and Pharisees who were from Jerusalem came to Jesus. So they came to him where he was up in the north in Galilee. And they had planned their verbal attack or their verbal accusations ahead of time. Why do your disciples transgress the tradition of the elders? And these were oral traditions that came out of the Babylonian captivity. They were not God's commands or God's laws written down anywhere. Why do they not wash their hands when they eat bread? And there was a symbolic washing that these rabbis were all supposed to go through. They would wash their hands so many times, dip them in water, and they had to hold them up in the air and let them air dry. They couldn't wipe them off on a towel because the towel might be somehow contaminating them. The disciples of Jesus Christ did not do that. They did not go through the ritual washing before they ate. He answered and said, why do you also transgress the commandment of God because of your tradition? So here we have people who pretended, at least wise in their mind, to obey God. They stated publicly they were worshiping God, and Jesus Christ said they were transgressing the commandment of God because of their own traditions. Then he gives them an example. God commanded, saying, honor your father and mother, and he who curses father or mother, let him be put to death. But you say, whoever says to his father or mother, whatever profit you might have received from me is a gift to God. In other words, korban or set aside. They need not honor his father or mother. So instead of taking care of the physical needs of his own parents, these Pharisees and scribes were keeping that money for themselves because they sort of had it set aside in this, quote, dedicated for a trust or for a special purpose, and they then did not take care of their mother or father like they should have. Jesus Christ said, you've made the commandment of God of no effect because of your tradition. So the teachings of these men that were passed down eventually became what we know as the Talmud. Not all of the verbal targums became the Talmud, but certainly quite a number of them did. He says, you've made the commandment of God of no effect by your tradition. Hypocrites, how well did Isaiah prophesy about you, saying, these people draw near to me with their mouth, and they honor me with their lips, but their heart is far from me. In vain they worship me, teaching as doctrines the commandments of men. How could people worship God in vain? Very simple. By teaching the doctrines of men, not the doctrines of God, the doctrines of the Bible. The response by Jesus went straight to the heart of why these religious leaders were not teaching the truth. Because they were more concerned about being leaders, about being recognized as famous rabbis. And so instead of teaching the doctrines of God, they taught the doctrines of other famous rabbis who were in captivity in Babylon, hoping apparently to raise themselves up in that amount of status. Let's drop over to Matthew chapter 23 and verse 1. Matthew 23, most of you know, is Jesus Christ's last talk, you might say, with the scribes and Pharisees of his day. And it's right, you know, it's during the last week of his life, during his last 7 days after coming up from Galilee, going to Bethany, raising Lazarus about 5 days before he was crucified, and of course having the crowds come around because the story of Lazarus being raised from the dead was just taking over Jerusalem by storm. So during this time, Jesus spoke to the multitudes and to his disciples, saying, "The scribes and Pharisees sit in Moses' seat. Whatever they tell you to do, observe." Now, why did he say that? If these scribes and Pharisees were doing things that were wrong, why did he say, "What they tell you to do, observe"? Well, the likely answer is that when they were in Moses' seat, they were reading the Torah. They were reading the Old Testament, the Old Torah and the prophets. They were sitting in Moses' seat and reading the scriptures. Even Paul later says, actually it's in the book of Acts 15, it says, they have Moses read to them every week in their synagogues. And so when the scribes and Pharisees sat in Moses' seat, they had their scripture readings for the week that they were then to observe, because God's word is absolute truth. Therefore, whatever they tell you to do, observe, that observe and do, but do not do according to their works, for they say and do not do. So though they read God's words every week, they then go out and do something different. And he mentions they bind heavy burdens, hard to bear, and lay them on men's shoulders, pretending, of course, that they are truth. It says they themselves will not move them with one of their fingers. All their works they do to be seen by men. That is a profound statement, because it tells so much about human nature. And it tells us a great deal about, unfortunately, people who have used the name of God and said they were worshiping God ever since the beginning of time. Nimrod founded his society on a system of false worship, of false religion. All the way down through the Roman Empire and modern society, it is simply the same. Men love the best places in verse 6 in the feast. They love the best seats in the synagogues and greetings in the marketplaces to be called rabbi, rabbi. But you do not be called rabbi, for one is your teacher, the Christ, and you are all brethren. So we have Jesus Christ telling, don't use the name of God or religion to be seen of men, to have special names and be called that in the marketplace, for indeed, that's not what you're here for. It's not truth. Let's drop down to verse 28. He kind of summarizes what he has here, what he's saying about this. This is the core of his case against them. He says, "Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites," verse 27, "for you are like whitewashed tombs, which indeed appear beautiful outwardly, but inside are full of dead men's bones and all uncleanness. Even so you also outwardly appear righteous to men, but inside you are full of hypocrisy and lawlessness." And so he's accusing them very plainly of rejecting truth, but pretending that their man-concocted truth is somehow good enough. Jesus Christ is saying it certainly is not. One of the most important scriptures on truth is over in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2. 2 Thessalonians, obviously a book that earlier in Paul's ministry, he's writing to a church that was a very positive church. He said a lot good to them and about them. He also warned them about some of the things that were coming their way as they were going to be experiencing the Roman Empire. In 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, beginning in verse 1, these people apparently had heard some false prophets. Some people had come to them and said, Jesus Christ has already returned. He's in some sort of special chambers, or he's already coming in the wind, much like our day where false prophets seem to have no end. Every year somebody's proclaiming once again that Christ is coming at a certain day or time. They've always got some special reason for that. He said, "Now, brethren, concerning the coming of our Lord Jesus Christ and our gathering together to him." Very important for us, because we are concerned about the return of Jesus Christ and the resurrection and all of God's people being gathered together to him. "We ask you not to be shaken in mind or troubled, either by spirit or by word or by letter." Don't be shaken if somebody says they've heard a spirit, or if they have some letter from someone, or if they have some message, even if it is a counterfeit letter from us, it says, as if from us, as though the day of Christ had already come. Let no one deceive you by any means. That day will not come unless the falling away comes first, and the man of sin is revealed, the son of perdition. Now, there have been fallings away occurring ever since Jesus Christ ascended to heaven and the church was started on the day of Pentecost in 31 AD. But the man of sin has yet to be revealed. Down through time, some Christians apparently have thought it was tyrants of their time, beginning with Nero, perhaps Diocletian, and some of the other Roman emperors. And after that, especially as the year 1000 came to be, there were those who put other names in there. In our history back in the 60s and 70s, I think we sort of made a game out of trying to predict who was going to be the beast. The problem is all the guys we predicted kept dying on us, Franz Josef Strauss and others. So whenever some minister would say, I don't think it might be so-and-so, then it's kind of like the death sentence. Within a few weeks or months, that guy would then die, and then we had to come up with a new name. So thankfully, I think we've gotten beyond that. We are going to wait for God to reveal him. None of us have to reveal the man of sin or the son of perdition. We do know what to look for. He opposes and exalts himself above all that is called God or that is worshipped. So he proclaims himself to be God, that he sits as God in the temple of God, showing himself that he is God. So it's a very visible, a very high-profile individual sitting in some temple of God that he proclaims as a temple of God, saying that he is God. So how that works out, we'll wait and see. He says, don't you remember that when I was with you, I told you these things? And now you know that what is restraining, that it may be revealed in his own time. So there's a restraint that God has put on the marches of evil so that his church can be raised up. The mystery of lawlessness is already at work. So there was a teaching of a secret religion or a mysterious religion against law, against the commandments of God, and Paul said it was already working. Only he who now restrains will do so until he's taken out of the way. And many think this is Paul referring to himself, that he was keeping all the false teachers at bay, and that when he died, then of course the church was taken over primarily by a lot of false teachings, and eventually the wrong day of the week and other things emerging in the second and third centuries AD. And that may be the way that he was referring to it, I don't know. But the lawless one will be revealed, whom the Lord will consume with the breath of his mouth and destroy with the brightness of his coming. Now that individual hasn't yet been revealed, because he will have to be alive when Jesus Christ returns and will be destroyed by the breath of his coming. Actually put into an abyss first, and then later, the lake of fire, will he'll be the first ones in there, the man of sin and the false prophet. That's pretty clear in Revelation. The coming of the lawless one is according to the working of Satan with all power, signs, and lying wonders. That's very much in line with other verses that tell us that the beast will have its power from the dragon and exist for 3.5 years. With all unrighteous deception among those who are perishing, because they did not receive the love of the truth that they might be saved. That's a very important truth. That when you receive the truth, it isn't just a matter of academic understanding. It is a matter of loving the truth in an emotional way, to where you are willing to give up everything else because this is the pearl of great price. And the fact that you are here, I think, today is proof indeed that you have a love of the truth. All of us who are in the ministry, who have visited people who are learning about the truth, could probably tell you that at least 2 out of 3, sometimes 4 out of 5 people that we would talk to that understood clearly the truth, thought about what it would cost, and then walked away. When I was in Tacoma, I received a phone call from a man who was pastor of the only church on Anderson Island, the Anderson Island Church. And he had to get out there with a ferry. I had one church member that lived out on Anderson Island. Fairly small island, mostly retirement or vacation homes. But there is a church out there, and the pastor called me. We talked several times on the phone. Finally, we went out and met at a restaurant up in Steilacoom. For several hours, we sat and went through every doctrine in the Bible. And he had proven conclusively that you shouldn't keep pagan holidays. He had proven you should keep the holy days. He had proven so many things. And I thought, boy, this is a great prospective member. This guy is going to be able to, and just one of these guys that just had a real charisma, personality, a lot of leadership. You could tell he was just a real dynamic, influential with all the people he knew, kind of like, you know, Ken Laux or someone like that. But just I thought, wow, this guy could really, you know, if God could call him and, you know, bring him to real repentance, he could someday be a real leader, because he was just the kind of guy that, wow, this is a real leader. So he said, well, I'm going to go home and talk to my wife and my daughters. He said, my wife is the music ministry director at our church. And this was in, I think, October, early November. And he said, she's working on her Christmas program at the church. He said, she's not going to like it when I tell her that we're not going to do Christmas anymore at church. So I left feeling pretty good, remembering the days when many of us would leave our colleges and our scholarships and our homes and somehow arrive at Ambassador College in Big Sandy and other places, arrive at God's church sort of tattered and torn, but willing to give it all for the truth. So he said he would call me in a week or two, and he never did. So after about 2 months passed, I called him back up. It was, I think, in January. It was right after the holiday season. And I asked him how he was doing and if I could help in any way. He said, well, he said, I sat and talked to my wife and my daughters, and they were all upset. And he said, I sat and thought about how much I was going to have to give up. He said, I'd have to probably quit my job. The church here wouldn't accept it. He said, it's just too much. He said, I know it's right. He said, what you and I talked about was right. But he said, I just can't do it. He hung up on me. Never heard from him again. Unfortunately, probably 3 or 4 or 5 out of every 100 people that God has repeated contact with have actually been willing to make the change. Because if you don't receive the love of the truth, you'll find a reason to do something else. And unfortunately, some people who did give up a lot and did come and for many years sit with us and worship with us, when it came time to be tested again and give it all up, friendships, relationships, whatever, fulfill what Paul said here. I said they did not believe, they did not stay because they did not receive the love of the truth that they might be saved. For this reason, God will send them strong delusion that they should believe the lie. And it is amazing how many people who understood the truth so quickly turned away and lost that knowledge of the truth. They fulfilled this verse that very quickly they were taken into delusion and believed the lie. This verse is a warning for all of us. We have to ask ourselves, how much do I really love the truth? Because loving the truth and living it are two requirements for staying in the truth and receiving even more of it. I want to go back to Luke chapter 19. There's a parable that illustrates this. This parable really tells us we can either build truth or lose it. You know, truth in your life is not stagnant. You can't simply memorize the package and then ride the conveyor belt into the kingdom of God. Because truth in your life is somewhat like a bucket full of small holes filled with water. It gradually seeps out because we have memories that are not perfect. We have to continually refill our bucket and grow in grace and knowledge of God's truth. Otherwise, eventually, we are going to be finding ourselves on the wayside. In Luke chapter 19, we have this parable of the minas. The minas was basically an amount of money. In verse 19, you know the story. The person who had turned his mina into 5 minas was responsible to be over 5 cities. The person that was responsible for had taken his mina and turned it into 10 minas, responsible over 10 cities. Another came, verse 20, and said, Master, here is your mina, which I have kept put away in a handkerchief. For I feared you. Notice it was fear that caused this man not to go out and do what his master instructed. It was fear that kept him from stepping out and developing, adding more truth to the truth he was already given. You collect what you do not deposit, you reap what you do not sow. He eventually began to find fault with the master who had given him the mina. He said, out of your own mouth I will judge you, you wicked servant. You knew that I was an austere man, collecting what I did not deposit and reaping what I did not sow. Why then did you not put my money in the bank, that at my coming I might have collected it with interest? At least give it to somebody else who will do something with it. And he said to those who stood by, take the mina from him and give it to him who has 10 minas. Now, this is kind of the lost part of this parable. Sometimes people skip over this. They go through the first three men. They think, well, one to develop 10, he gets 10 cities. The one who developed 5, he gets 5 cities. And the man who was paralyzed by fear gets punished. But the interesting thing is that mina then is given to the one who produced the most. He already had so much truth, he gained even more. And the master said, well, give it to the man that has 10. For I say to you that everyone who has given will be given, and from him who does not have, even what he has will be taken away from him. So the principle is very obvious. You know, truth either grows or dies. It either has to grow in your life, or you're eventually going to see it disappearing from your life. We are all like plants. If a plant stops growing, it dies. And we are to learn that lesson from the plants that we see. Our life is not to be stagnant. If we really want Christ to rule over us, we'll be searching for more and more ways to apply that truth in our life. Let's go over to Psalm chapter 111, Psalm chapter 111, just to get a couple basic verses here. God mentions that we are going to understand more than all of the ancients, than all of the people of history, because we do his commandments. It is a matter of first understanding them, but then also doing or performing his commandments. Psalm 111, the last verse, verse 10. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. A good understanding have all those who do his commandments. His praise endures forever. So it is not just hearing, but it is doing. You know, faith without works is dead or is dying. And truth without doing it, without living it, is also dying. You know, we live in a land where it's very difficult sometimes to understand exactly how much relativism has affected us. I want to read that little article about the relativistic fog. Why moral relativism can't be true. This is from summit.org. I could not find the name of any author. Consider these well-worn slogans. What's right for you might not be right for me. Everyone has to decide for himself what is right. And what is right depends on the situation. Now, where have you heard these phrases and these terms, these well-worn slogans before? Well, my guess is you've heard them if you've gone to any high school graduations in the last 20 years. I always like to go to the graduations of the youth in the congregations that we serve. I noticed back in the day when I graduated high school, it's been so long ago now, some of you might not even remember that far back, but I went to a very large high school. We actually had a senator, a U.S. senator, came and gave the high school graduation ceremony. And even the students who spoke in terms of achieving greatness, of giving back to the world, the great blessings we'd had for being Americans, of doing things to make society better and increasing life for all that came in contact with them, at least aspired to, you know, higher and bigger things. In about 20 years ago, that began to change. I first noticed it when we were in Alaska and attending some graduations up there. The statements that were given out were not follow what is right, but decide for yourself what is right and then follow it. It's a statement that makes no sense, because if you are your own authority and you come up on a situation where you want to do something you said you didn't want to do, but now you're not accountable to anybody, so you just can go ahead and compromise however you want to. They spout terms like what is right for you might not be right for somebody else. We live in a time where what is right and wrong is not determined by a higher power who created us, but instead by feelings and what makes people feel one way or another. That everybody has a right to decide for himself what is right or wrong. George Barna mentioned in one of his studies, this is interesting because this study came from February 2002, only 5 months after the attacks on the New York Twin Towers. And he mentioned in here that among adults and one among teenagers, people were asked if they believe there are moral absolutes, that are unchanging and that moral truth is relative to the circumstances. By a 3-to-1 margin, adults said that truth is always relative to the person and their situation. The perspective was even more lopsided among teenagers, 83% of whom said moral truth depends on the circumstances. Only 6% of teenagers, this is 13 years ago, said that moral truth is absolute. I guess it'd be 14 years ago. The gap between teen and adult views was not surprising. However, when the adult views were considered by generation, 6 out of 10 people, 36 and older, embraced moral relativism, and 75% of the adults, 18 to 35, did so. Thus, it's obvious relativism is gaining ground, largely because relativism appears to have taken root with the generation that preceded today's teenagers. So it hasn't just been in the last 15, 20 years, the idea that all truth is relative and that people can always decide for themselves what is right and wrong has been around for pushing 40 years. Authors Beckwith and Kuchel, who wrote on the subject, says moral relativism asserts there are no universally objective right or wrong answers, no inappropriate or appropriate judgments, and no reasonable or rational ways by which to make moral distinctions that apply in every time, in every place, to every person. Only subjective opinions exist, which are no different from one's feelings about a favorite football team, movie star, or ice cream flavor. Now think about that for a minute. Moral decisions are on the same level as your favorite ice cream flavor. Yet that's what these surveys have turned up. One assumption that is foundational to moral relativism is biological evolution, which is itself either rooted in atheistic or pantheistic religious overview. Now, what's interesting in our society is if you study some of the evolution of evolution, that years ago people still believed that God used evolution to create. That led to a time when people simply became atheists and said, well, there is no God and we'll just do what we want. In recent times, especially led by Hollywood, the pantheism idea has taken hold, which basically says that people are God. Shirley MacLaine used to say that at the very end of her presentations, I guess not a presentation, her show she would do in Las Vegas. She would just scream over and over, "You are God, you are God, you are God," to the audience, trying to convince her audience that they were the highest power in the universe. And if that's the case, then there are certain ramifications of that. People can decide they are smarter than and therefore able to organize the lives of other people, and we have socialism and other things that are very rampant all over the world. He mentions here, in either case, the implication for ethics is that the individual must create his or her own moral values, and these personally held values will change from individual to individual, therefore making morality a subjective experience. But what about different cultures? To bolster the idea of moral relativism, someone may bring up the point that different cultures have different standards of conduct. For example, historically in Japan, if an owner's business defaults, the honorable thing for the owner to do was to commit suicide. In contrast to that, in the United States and Great Britain, it was customary in the past to wind up the business as best one could and pay off as many debtors as possible. Now the honorable thing to do is to hire a lawyer, go through bankruptcy, and pay as few debts as possible. If you want to see a moral relativist turn into a moral absolutist, all you have to do is take his MP3 player from him. All of a sudden, he believes in stealing, that stealing is wrong, because you've stolen something that belonged to him. So at least you've got him to admit to one moral standard, that stealing is wrong. If there is one standard, then the person can no longer claim to be an absolute relativist. So these things go through kind of some mind games, but the important thing to understand is that we live in a society where, since truth has evaded people, and since religion has gone all over the place in being relativistic, that the understanding of real truth and holding fast to and loving truth is more important now than it ever has been. Let's go to 1 Corinthians chapter 2, beginning in verse 1. You see, the idea that moral relativism infects society is important. It also has affected American religion in a big way. Years and years ago, there were mainstream churches that dominated the landscape. had Catholic, of course, Presbyterian, Lutheran, Methodist, these great big massive brick edifices that dotted all over the country and seemed to dominate society, Baptists especially in the South. In the past 40 years, small independent sort of nondiscreet churches popped up everywhere, seemingly on every street corner like mushrooms in the springtime, with all sorts of different names. You know, new life, old life, exciting life, this hill, that hill, this street, these corners. I'm amazed at the new numbers of names that they've been able to come up with for American churches. One thing most of them have in common is that they deliberately avoid teaching church doctrine. They teach only the very, very basics, because actually teaching doctrine causes people to become divided. There's an article on the internet called "Why Do Some Pastors Deliberately Avoid Teaching Their Church Doctrine?" This is by a writer named Jim Elliff, E-L-L-I-F-F, April 2007. He says, "I've been involved in leading churches for four decades with an emphasis on church planting in the last few years." So when they go somewhere and start these little corner churches, they call that church planting. "I've also visited and addressed hundreds of churches around the world, and I've had the privilege of meeting thousands of Christian leaders. Through this time, I've watched an unintentional doctrinal imprecision on the part of many pastors become intentional. In other words, I have witnessed a new conventional wisdom emerge. Simply stated, it is the wisdom of attempting to circle in more people for our churches by unashamedly minimizing or perhaps nearly eradicating the restricting influences of doctrine. What pastors used to do, because of being poorly taught perhaps, they now do intent, justifying it by the needs for church growth." What he is saying is that American churches have gotten away from doctrine and actual teaching, despite the fact that Paul told Timothy, give attention daily to doctrine. They do it because they want numbers. They want larger numbers at their mega churches, and when they start these little corner churches up, the important thing is to get, you know, a critical mass of so many people. To do that, they have to simply not teach doctrine, but only teach some of the very, very basics. That is a very strong trend in our society that we've seen. We cannot let it happen in the Church of God. We must maintain a very rigid wall around the truth, the doctrine that we teach, and never let this watering down for numbers affect us. Continuing on in this article, it says here, "The problem is, it is working. For instance, I just visited with one friend concerning a large church in our area that has grown exceptionally well. The directional pastor of this church is a smart man who has some distinct beliefs he holds personally. I can talk with him about doctrine when alone he reads and knows the Bible, but in his leadership and preaching, he fully intends not to go beyond the most elementary issues and appears not to be concerned that his people often differ on major doctrines, some of which are most significant. Outside of an expression of the gospel and some how-tos, there isn't much to get your teeth into his preaching. He has created a birthing station, but not much else. Doctrine does narrow things, and we don't like that word narrow. Where will you find one person who is attracted to sound doctrine? You will find 100 who wants to allow all sorts of beliefs to be tolerated. I have been in such churches where great heresies were listened to as if it were perfectly permissible to hold such views as, quote, your opinion. And I'm not talking about the guests there, but those who are regular members." You see, what happens in the world does affect all of us. It can affect our church, even in religious ways. So we have to make sure that those who are teaching God's truth and those who are writing, and those who are proclaiming the truths of the world are, as Paul instructed Timothy, to be dealing in doctrine and in the real truths and teachings of the Bible, because it is the pearl of great price. The watered-down, simple basics, as this man talked about them, are not what we need. They won't let anybody attain God's kingdom. In 1 Corinthians chapter 2, Paul wrote to a world that was worshiping the Roman emperor. And the world of Rome was one where religion was first and foremost in many people's minds, but it's something they had to do to placate the gods. They had to take a sacrifice to the altar of one of the temples or to several temples, as long as they acknowledged that Caesar was over them all, and they could go on their merry way and prosper as Romans did. In 1 Corinthians chapter 2, writing to this very pagan and very false religion-riddled town, Paul said, "Brethren, when I came to you, I did not come with excellence of speech or of wisdom declaring to you the testimony of God. It wasn't a matter of flowery speech or of great wordy speeches like Cicero would make, or perhaps Socrates, some of the great Greeks. It wasn't the wisdom of men." He says, "I determined not to know anything among you except Jesus Christ and him crucified." And of course, that includes the forgiveness of sin, the establishing of his kingdom, and not just a very narrow one-sentence teaching. "I was with you in weakness and in fear and in much trembling, and my speech and my preaching were not with persuasive words of human wisdom, but in the demonstration of the Spirit and of power, that your faith should not be in the wisdom of men, but in the power of God." So we are not building numbers based on the wisdom of men, but Jesus Christ is building his church based on the power of God. "However, we speak wisdom among those who are mature." So what we say is wisdom for those who are mature in understanding the truth. "Yet not the wisdom of this age, nor of the rulers of this age, who are coming to nothing." Might be a really good memory verse for all of us. The rulers of this age are coming to nothing. You know, there's an old saying that when little men cast big shadows, the sun is about to set. And certainly we see that around us, like this dictator over in Korea, many of the leaders around the Middle East, other places. Little people who are casting great big shadows now, perhaps harbinger of the times in which we live, the closeness of Christ's return. But let's go on. Verse 7, we speak the wisdom of God hid in a mystery, the hidden wisdom of God ordained before the ages for our glory. So God's wisdom is hidden, only given to those whom God calls and then who respond to that call. "None of the rulers of this age knew, for had they known, they would not have crucified the Lord of glory. But as it is written, eye has not seen, nor ear heard, nor has it entered into the heart of man the things which God has prepared for those who love him." It doesn't just mean that people don't understand they're not going to heaven. The entire panorama of man's ideas about what happens after you die, it just covers everything. It's much bigger than that. He's saying here, the things which God has prepared for those who love him, I think includes the entire message of the gospel, everything that Jesus Christ taught. All of the truth, because it is the truth, not just some or not just a part of. But the truth of God is what God has prepared for us. Verse 10, God has revealed them to us through his Spirit. God has revealed his truth to us through his Spirit. The Spirit searches all things, yes, the deep things of God. For what man knows the things of a man except the spirit of a man which is in him? So men understand manly or humanly things. Even so, no one understands the things of God except the Spirit of God. So the truth of God, which Jesus Christ said, "Thy word is truth," in John 17:17, the truth of God is only revealed by the Spirit of God. Now we have received not the spirit of the world, but the Spirit who is from God, that we might know the things that have been freely given to us by God. The most valuable thing in existence is truth, and that truth has been freely given to you by God. We didn't pay for it, we didn't buy it, we didn't sell our house, we didn't mortgage our kids, anything. God freely gave us his truth. These things which we also speak, not in words which man's wisdom teaches, but which the Holy Spirit teaches, comparing spiritual things with spiritual. Because truth is based in spirit. It is a spiritual understanding that we seek and that we must have. Let's go over to Romans chapter 10. Paul understood that the church had been given a special understanding and a responsibility to teach the truth. Truth is one of those things that the more you try to give it away, the more you have of it. The more we try to teach and make efforts to teach God's truth to the world, the more we better understand it ourselves and the more we understand its value. If we ever decide we're simply going to sit and wait for Christ to return and hold on to the truth that we have, we will indeed begin to lose it. Romans chapter 10 and verse 14 says, "How then shall they call on him in whom they have not believed? And in whom, how shall they believe in him if they haven't heard about him? And how shall they hear without a preacher? How shall they preach unless they are sent? As it is written, how beautiful are the feet of those who preach the gospel of peace and who bring glad tidings of good things." So there are preachers that have to be sent. That's the way Almighty God ordained it. We have record of Jesus Christ not only calling prophets and working with them in the Old Testament, but also those whom he called and those whom he ordained in the New Testament to go out and preach the truth. An interesting principle over in Hebrews chapter 5 and verse 4. I think we have time to turn over there. Hebrews 5 and verse 4. In this case, he's actually talking about the office of high priest, but later he makes the connection that the priesthood has now been given to the New Testament ministry, or the priesthood responsibilities have been passed on, and we'll talk about that more in future weeks, I'm sure. But in Hebrews chapter 5 and verse 4, it says, "No man takes this honor to himself, but he was called by God just as Aaron was." So no man takes the honor of being a priest or representing God to himself. The principle is that God the Father must decide, and God the Father must choose. He says in verse 5, "So also Christ did not glorify himself to become high priest, but it was he who said to him, 'You are my son, today I have begotten you.' He also says in another place, 'You are a priest forever, according to the order of Melchizedek.'" So here we have really a biblical principle that we cannot forget, that those who would proclaim themselves or set themselves up as those who would be preachers of the truth often then can be instead deceiving themselves and deceiving others because they simply are not in line or not ordained to it because of Jesus Christ's ordination. Over in Daniel chapter 12, one of the most incredible prophecies about people having understanding at the end time. These are people that understand truth. We are closer to this time now than we ever have been. Looking at some of the potential wars and disasters around the world, one might think that a lot of people would be motivated to begin to want to understand truth. The Shias and the Sunnis are on the verge of a massive war in the Middle East, which they used to be, but then we took out Saddam Hussein, who was the Sunni fighter, and against the Shias. Now it seems like the Saudis have taken up the mantle, but at least be aware of what's going on over there and watch some of those things between all of the sports and all of the comedy shows and all of the inane nothingness that's on the evening news. Look on the internet, at least try to find out what's going on between Iran and Saudi Arabia. They are both trying to get nuclear weapons as fast as they can. And of course, if they started into a war, it would embroil Pakistan and many other nations very quickly. But we are on the verge of a very challenging time. Daniel chapter 12, verse 1, "At that time Michael shall stand up." Michael is the prince who stands watch over the people of Israel. "He shall have to protect them to keep them from being annihilated. There shall be a time of trouble such as never was since there was a nation." Jesus Christ talked about a time of tribulation like never had been before and never will be again. "Even at that time your people shall be delivered, everyone who is found written in the book. Many of those who sleep in the dust of the earth shall awake, some to everlasting life, some to shame and everlasting contempt." He's talking about the time after Christ returns and the great judgment of all people, which of course comes in several resurrections. "Those who are wise shall shine like the brightness of the firmament." Those who are wise are those who have truth, who live by truth, who are growing in truth, and have given everything else in their life up for it. "Like the brightness of the firmament, and those who turn many to righteousness." Just read about those in Romans, about those who teach, those who are sent to teach. "Those who turn many to righteousness, like the stars forever and ever. But you, Daniel, shut up the words and seal the book until the time of the end." It says, "Many shall run to and fro, and knowledge shall be increased." And of course, that today is more true than it ever has been. We thought it was true back in the time of air travel. Mr. Armstrong used to remark about a person could get on a boat and go all the way across the ocean in 10 days instead of 3 months. And that meant that people were going to and fro on the face of the earth. And back in the 1930s, that was true. But what we have today is much closer to the transporter of Mr. Solo than it is the airplanes of their day. But it says, "You, Daniel, shut up the words. Many shall run to and fro. Knowledge shall be increased. Then I, Daniel, looked, and there stood two other angels, one on this riverbank, on the other on that riverbank." When there's a river, that normally means there's a divide. And he's talking about how that divide is going to be crossed. "And one said to the man clothed in linen who was above the waters of the river, 'How long shall the fulfillment of these wonders be?' Then I heard the man clothed in linen who was above the waters of the river. He held up his right hand and his left hand." So he held both his hands up to heaven. "And he swore by him who lives forever and ever that it shall be for a time, times, and half a time. And when the power of the holy people has been completely shattered, all these things shall be finished." Notice the power of the people is shattered, not the people themselves. "Although I heard, I did not understand. Then I said, 'My Lord, what shall be the end of these things?'" How is this going to all work out? What's the final, you know, fulfillment of all these prophecies and visions? Daniel deserved to know, but the angel simply said, "Go your way, Daniel, for the words are closed and sealed up until the time of the end, when many shall be purified and made white and refined, but the wicked shall do wickedly, and none of the wicked shall understand." So the wicked do not understand truth. The wicked live in a society where falsehood, where Satan's ideas, where the father of lies is followed, very much different than the wise who shall understand. But the bottom line of this verse is that at the end, right before Jesus Christ returns, and during that time, that there will be wise who understand. There will be wise people who have the knowledge of the truth. And that indeed is why we are here. I want to conclude now on probably the second to the last book written in the Bible, 3 John. If you look at the writings of John, 3 John written apparently right before Revelation was, certainly in the late 80s, perhaps early 90s AD, some even put it up past 100 AD, I don't know if that's accurate or not, but 3 John is all about the word truth. He's admonishing us to stay in the truth, to walk in the truth, to hold on to the truth, despite the challenging times we are living in. 3 John, verse 1, "To the elder, to the beloved Gaius," we really don't know who he is except a beloved person to the Apostle John, "whom I love in truth." So the subject of this very short book, 14 verses, is truth. "I pray that you prosper in all things and be in health just as your soul prospers." His soul prospered because he was in the truth and living the truth. "I rejoice greatly when brethren came and testified of the truth that is in you, just as you walk in the truth." Now, could this be said about you if John were writing you a letter? That the truth is in you. You understand God's truth. You've stayed away from all the false ideas. You held on to the fabulous pearl of great price and the truth that God has revealed. He says, "I have no greater joy than to hear that my children walk." They live according to the truth. Because, of course, that truth they live in means they're going to be growing in truth and having more and more of it giving to them. "Beloved, you do faithfully whatever you do for the brethren and for the strangers who have borne witness of your love before the church. If you send them forward on their journey in a worthy manner of God, you will do well." So he said, take care of those who are traveling through and who are in your area who also live in the truth. "Because they went forth for his name's sake, taking nothing from the Gentiles." He's talking about some people who were doing God's work, who were preachers sent forth, and who were going into an area of the Gentiles. "Therefore, we ought to receive such that we may become fellow workers for the truth." And so we are to be fellow workers for the truth, as John told these people, doing all that we can to love the truth, to walk in the truth, to be thankful for the truth, and to realize that this pearl of great price is what all humanity seeks, but only a very small number of people have it. Jesus Christ said that you shall know the truth, and the truth shall set you free, meaning real freedom, not freedom to the mental confines of understanding or believing falsehoods. You are truly free, and you have known the truth by living the truth and living in real freedom. And God speed the day when that truth can be brought to the entire earth.